beautiful souls, welcome to the very first episode of the Crimson Playhouse podcast, where stories come alive, music moves you, and creativity flows freely. I'm your host, Crimson Renee. I'm an artist, storyteller, and I'm an actress, and I am your guide on this journey into the worlds I've been dreaming up. If you're new here, hello and welcome. You can also check out my music on Apple Music and Spotify, or wherever you dream your favorite tunes. You know, whether you're vibing to some smooth R&B, you like a little bit of pop, or you know, you just want some music to vibe to whilst you're studying or you're meditating, I've got something for you. All right. Now, let me tell you what to expect here at the Crimson Playhouse. This podcast is your front row seat to the serialized stories that I'm writing. I'm going to be narrating them and performing them for you. And, you know, think romance, think drama, passion, heartbreak, everything that you need to escape, to feel and dream a little bit deeper. I'm going to have something for you. Each week, I'll be sharing a different chapter from my series, and we're going to be starting with The Velvet Muse. It's a soulful, emotional romance drama, and I can't wait for you to hear it. The Velvet Muse. Born with jazz in her veins and her father's legacy echoing through every neon corner of the Velvet Muse, Liza Thornberry's story is one of passion, resilience, and a love that refuses to fade. After escaping the chaos of Los Angeles, she's returned to Baywood Heights, her hometown, carrying the weight of heartbreak and the hope of a fresh start. But nothing is simple when the past lingers like a bittersweet melody, especially when her ex, Mason Tate, steps back into her life, stirring emotions that Liza thought she'd buried. And when things get messy, along comes Maxwell Hayes, a captivating musician whose smooth saxophone solos and irresistible smile might just be the spark Liza didn't know she needed. The Velvet Muse is a journey through love, loss, legacy, and the courage to start over. And I'm so excited to share it with you chapter by chapter right here. But wait, there's more. If you want early access to episodes, bonus chapters, alternate scenes, or just deeper dives into my stories in general, head over to the Crimson Playhouse Patreon. It's where I share exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. You'll get deleted scenes, you'll get some behind the scenes looks, and you'll even get some Q&A sessions up in there. Sometimes we even have some polls going on where you get to really choose which characters I dive into, or even choose what the exclusive content is going to be. You know? Who knows? Just come over. Come over. We're going to have a lot of fun. And if podcasts aren't enough, I will also be posting the chapters over on YouTube. So if you're over there, subscribe to our Crimson Playhouse channel. I'll also be sharing affirmation music and meditation music. And you can also see some of my music videos up there too. All right, beautiful people, it's time. Grab your favorite drink, get comfortable, and let's dive into chapter one of The Velvet Muse. Let's step into Baywood Heights together as I introduce you to Liza. The Velvet Muse. Chapter 1. The first thing I noticed about Baywood Heights was the way the sky burned. Streaks of molten orange bled into velvet purples, the kind of sunset that begged to be captured and saved forever. But I didn't have time for pictures. My fingers gripped the steering wheel as if letting go would send me spinning off the edge of my sanity. 5 hours. That's how long I'd driven from Los Angeles. Watching the city shrink in my rearview mirror while I tried to convince myself I wasn't making a monumental mistake. The GPS chimed. In 200 feet, your destination will be on the left. And there it was, the Velvet Muse. My father's dream, my inheritance, my burden. I pulled to the curbside spot and killed the engine. The car rattling to silence like it, too, was ready to give up on me. For a moment, I just sat there, staring at the building as if it could tell me what to do next. The once vibrant red brick looked tired, its face weathered and peeling. The neon sign blinked with the desperation of something that didn't know whether it wanted to live or die, missing its V and barely clinging to life. I stepped out of the car and inhaled the crisp evening air, laced with the faint scent of salt from the nearby bay. Memories hit me in waves, flooding my senses before I could brace myself. Jazz drifting into the night like a lullaby, my father's laugh booming from behind the bar, the warmth of this place back when it had been a haven instead of a haunting. Grief is funny that way. It doesn't knock politely or call ahead. It crashes in uninvited when you least expect it.
Liza Thornberry,
a voice called from behind.
Look who decided to come home.
I turned to find Marcy Owens leaning against the lamppost, her silhouette framed by the last streaks of daylight. Her locks cascaded over her shoulders, longer and thicker than I remembered, but her mischievous smirk was the same, like she was waiting for me to join in on the next adventure. Marcy, I breathed, the sound of her name filling the hollow spaces in my chest. She crossed the street with the kind of confidence that made people stop and watch, her arms outstretched before pulling me into a hug that smelled like shea butter and cinnamon.
You look good, she said, stepping back and giving me a once-over.
A little tired, but still cute.
I laughed, the sound strained but welcome. Long drive.
And even longer journey ahead, she replied, glancing at the velvet muse.
Her gaze softened. Your dad would be proud you came back. The lump in my throat doubled in size. Marcy had always known when to push and when to let me breathe. Back in high school, when those cafeteria bullies thought it would be funny to make a scene out of me, she was the one who shut them down so hard they didn't dare make eye contact for the rest of the year. That was Marcy, my protector, when I couldn't protect myself. Now her eyes held the same fierce loyalty as if she was silently promising to fight whatever battles lay ahead.
I don't know if I'm ready, I whispered.
Whoever is, Marcy shrugged.
Come on, let's get inside before folks get chatty.
Inside, the club smelled like time had folded in on itself. Dust, leather, and faded memories swirling in the dim light. The velvet curtains framing the stage had bled from rich burgundy to a sad faded pink, and the wooden floor groaned beneath us, each step a reminder of how long it had been since anyone had danced here. But the bones of the place were still strong. The heartbeat of the velvet muse posed faintly, waiting to be revived. Marcy spun around, her arms wide.
It's not as bad as I expected.
I raised an eyebrow.
That's a lie. She laughed, grabbing a broom from behind the bar and tossing it my way. Okay, fine. It's bad, but nothing a little elbow grease and a lot of wine can't fix.
And a miracle, I muttered, catching the broom. As we swept the years of dust and neglect, Marcy filled the silence with updates on her life.
Got laid off last month, she said, her broom swishing across the floor. Corporate downsizing or whatever excuse they came up with, but it's cool. Severance package was generous. Plus, now I've got time to help you get this place back on its feet.
You don't have to do that, I said, pausing mid-sweep.
Stop. You know I'm not going anywhere, she grinned,
her eyes twinkling with the same energy that had once dared me to sneak out past curfew.
Besides, Tara's in middle school now. Can you believe that? My baby's a preteen with an attitude to match.
I smiled, imagining Marcy trying to outsmart a miniature version of herself. She's lucky to have you.
She's lucky I haven't strangled her yet, Marcy joked. And dating as a single mom? Ugh, don't get me started. Men hear you have a kid and suddenly they forget how to text back. Idiots, I said with a laugh. You know it. She leaned on her broom, her smile fading slightly. Speaking of people still around, Mason's been around. The air shifted, like the room had inhaled and forgotten how to exhale. I focused on the broom in my hands, sweeping furiously at a spot that didn't need cleaning. I didn't come back for him. Marcy studied me, her gaze steady. I know, but he's a part of this place. Always has been. Her words hung between us, heavy and undeniable. Mason Harris, the boy who had been my first love and my greatest heartbreak. The man who, despite everything, had never really let me go. I'm not here to dig up old wounds, I said. But even as the words left my mouth, I felt their fragility. Marcy nodded, letting the conversation drop like a stone in still water. All right, let's focus on cleaning for now. By the time the sun had fully set, the club felt alive again. The sticky bar had been scrubbed clean, the stage cleared of debris, and the mismatched chairs arranged in neat rows as if they were waiting for an audience. It's a start, Marcy said, wiping her hands on her jeans. I stood in the middle of the room, my chest rising and falling as I took it all in. For the first time, the weight of this place didn't feel suffocating. You're gonna be fine, Marcy said, her voice gentle. You always land on your feet. I wanted to believe her, but as I stared at the ghost of what this place used to be, with my father's legacy hanging over me and the memory of Mason lurking in the shadows, all I could think was this. I had no idea how to rebuild my life, but I was here, and maybe for now, that was enough. Chapter 2. Morning arrived like an unwelcome guest, dragging me out of a restless sleep and into a headache that pounded behind my eyes. It took a few groggy seconds to remember where I was, the small apartment above the Velvet Mews, once a haven during the summers when the world felt simpler. Now, it was a time capsule of cracked wallpaper, thrift store furniture, and a faint smell of dust that clung to everything. And the drilling noise? Definitely not a figment of my imagination. Groaning, I rolled out of bed and fumbled toward the tiny bathroom where the mirror on the wall greeted me with brutal honesty. My curls were a chaotic mess, my cheeks still creased from the pillow, and my eyes carried the kind of exhaustion makeup could not hide. Not that I cared, until I remembered who was downstairs. That realization made me pause. I splashed cold water on my face, brushed my teeth, and raked my fingers through my curls in a half-hearted attempt at taming them. With a sigh, I pinched my cheeks for a little color, threw on a sweatshirt, and headed down the creaky stairs toward the noise. The main floor was a flurry of activity, hammering, drilling, and the scraping of heavy furniture being dragged across the worn wooden floors. In the center of it all, clipboard in hand and commanding attention like he was born to lead, stood Mason Harris. He was the kind of man you could spot from across a crowded room and feel the weight of his presence before he even looked your way. Broad shoulders filled out a dark gray t-shirt, his tattooed arms flexing subtly with every gesture, his meticulously groomed beard framed strong jawline that hadn't softened with time, and the perfectly shaped waves on his head made him look effortlessly put together. And those eyes, dark, intense, and as familiar as they were dangerous, found mine the moment I stepped into the room. For a second, the chaos around us blurred into white noise. I wasn't ready for this. Mason's jaw tightened, and he gripped the clipboard like it was the only thing keeping him grounded. His eyes lingered on me just a moment too long before he turned to address his team, barking out instructions with practiced ease.
"Load those boards into the truck," he said,
his voice calm but with an edge, as though I'd knocked him off balance and he was fighting to regain control. "You're starting early," I said, crossing my arms as I walked farther into the room. The posture was instinctual, a shield against whatever reaction he might throw my way. My tone had bite, but it felt like a front I wasn't sure I could maintain for long. Mason didn't miss a beat.
"We start early, so we finish early," he replied,
his tone clipped.
"Figured you'd appreciate us getting ahead of schedule."
"Sure," I shot back, glancing around the room at the workers, hauling broken chairs and prying up floorboards. "A warning would have been nice." He barely looked at me.
"You could have stayed in LA if you wanted peace and quiet."
The comment stung, but I brushed it off with a sarcastic smile. "And miss this chaos? Never." Marcy strode in, two cups of coffee in hand. She handed one to me and gave Mason a pointed look. "Play nice, you two. There's enough work to do without all the tension." Mason didn't respond. Instead, he adjusted the clipboard, gave a curt nod, and walked off toward the stage. But I noticed the way his shoulders tensed as he walked away. He wasn't as unaffected as he wanted me to believe.
"He's still got that brooding thing down," Marcy said, nudging me with her elbow.
I forced a laugh, even as my chest tightened. "You think?" The day dragged on, each hour filled with the sounds of drills, hammers, and the distant hum of nostalgia threatening to drown me. Mason's team worked like a machine, tearing down old fixtures and hauling debris out back. I tried to stay busy, wiping down counters and sorting through boxes of my dad's forgotten treasures, old records, photographs, ticket stubs, and handwritten notes that smelled faintly of cologne and memories I wasn't ready to confront.
"Boss," one of the workers called to Mason, "there's rot under the section of the stage. Gonna need a full replacement."
Mason sighed, running a hand over his head.
"Figures."
He crouched down to inspect the damage, his expression hardening. "That's gonna cost a fortune, isn't it?" I asked, stepping closer. He stood and dusted off his hands.
"It's not cheap, but if you want to sell this place for a decent price, you'll need to do it right."
"You assume I'm planning to sell." My voice came out sharper than I intended. Mason looked at me, really looked at me this time. His dark eyes softened just slightly, like he was trying to read between the lines.
"Aren't you?"
I crossed my arms, standing firm. "No, I'm not going anywhere." For a moment, the room seemed to hold its breath, his gaze locked on mine, steady and searching, until something in him shifted. He nodded once, writing something down in his clipboard before turning to his team. But as he walked away, I saw him glance over his shoulder, as if he couldn't help himself. The conversation with Mason lingered in my mind long after he walked away. The way he assumed I would sell the club, the insinuation that I would leave it all behind permanently, stirred something deep within me. I needed to clear my head, so I grabbed my coat and left the building, stepping into the cold, cool air of Baywood Heights. I wandered down the familiar streets, my boots crunching against the pavement, The town hadn't changed much, though some storefronts had new signs and a fresh coat of paint brightened others. My first stop was an old bookstore, its bell jingling as I walked in.
"Liza Thornbury," Miss Bellum said, her face lighting up in recognition. She'd been the school librarian when I was a child, and seeing her here brought a flood of nostalgia. "Back in town for good?"
"Looks like it," I replied, offering a small smile. "I'm working on reopening my dad's club." Her eyes widened.
"The Velvet Muse? That's wonderful!
We've all missed it. Missed what it brought to the community. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help." I ended up spending around 20 minutes catching up with Miss Bellum, who seemed genuinely thrilled about the club's reopening. She shared fond memories of bringing her husband there for date nights and even promised to come to the soft opening. Her excitement was infectious, and for the first time in a while, I felt a flicker of confidence in my decision to stay. Her enthusiasm warmed me, and as I left the shop, a spark of hope replaced some of the heaviness weighing on my chest. I stopped into a few more places, each encounter similar. Familiar faces excited about the club's return, reminiscing about the memories it held for them. It was clear the Velvet Muse wasn't just a business. It was a corner store of the town. Eventually, I found myself at the farmer's market. The stalls brimmed with colorful produce, baked goods, and handmade crafts. I brought a smoothie from a vendor I vaguely remembered, and as I sipped, a memory surfaced. Years ago, Mason and I had come here for a date. We'd spent the afternoon wandering the market, laughing and teasing each other over who could pick the best fruit smoothie cocktail. The memory hit me like a wave, the happiness of that moment colliding with the ache of the present. I glanced around, half expecting to see him here, but of course he wasn't. Still, the memory lingered, a reminder that no matter where I went in Baywood Heights, I couldn't escape him. When I returned to the club, the sun had dipped low, casting the building in a warm glow. The day had been long and emotionally draining, but hearing familiar faces talk about the Velvet Muse reminded me this wasn't just about honoring my father's memory. It was about creating something of my own. Marcy and I sat at the bar, sipping bottled water, surveying the progress.
"So," I said, smirking, "you and that guy working on the stage, Andre, was it?"
Marcy choked on her water.
"What? No, we were just talking about the work."
"Uh-huh," I teased. She rolled her eyes, but her smile gave her away.
"Focus on your own drama. You got Mason lurking around like a storm cloud."
I laughed, but my fingers toyed with the cap on my water bottle.
"It's complicated." "Complicated how?" she pressed. "You haven't seen him in years. And honestly, I still don't understand why you ran away. Or why you cut me off, for that matter."
Her words stung, but they weren't wrong. I sighed, setting the bottle down. I was hurt. I felt like staying here wasn't an option, like I needed a fresh start. I glanced at her, guilt knotting in my stomach. "But I shouldn't have shut you out. I'm sorry, Mars. Seeing you now, seeing how much my actions hurt you too, I didn't realize what I was doing to everyone else." Marcy's expression softened, and she reached out to squeeze my hand. "I missed you, you know. And yeah, it sucked when you left like that, but I'm glad you're here now. And even if the circumstances suck, it feels right having you back."
"Thanks," I said quietly, the knot loosening just a little. "That means a lot." I missed this, having a best friend, someone who truly cared. The past 3 years in LA had been filled with acquaintances and associates,
People who wouldn't have noticed if I disappeared. Sitting here with Marcy, I realized just how much I'd been craving this connection, even if I didn't admit it to myself until now. Later that night, as I lay in bed staring at the cracked ceiling, my phone buzzed on the nightstand. I reached for it, expecting a spam email or maybe a weather alert, but instead, Mason's name lit up the screen. My stomach flipped and my thumb hovered over the notification for a second too long before I opened it. I hadn't received a message from him in 3 years. Mason, we need to talk. My breath hitched. The ghosts of everything we left unsaid had finally come knocking. All right, so that was chapter 1 and chapter 2 of The Velvet Muse. I hope that you enjoyed it. Come back next week for chapter 3, and let's see how Liza and Mason are getting on then. Don't forget to check out our Patreon page if you want to know what's going to happen before next week. If you cannot wait until next week, hop on over to the Patreon page. I do have a few chapters already uploaded there. But again, my name is Crimson Renee, and it's been my pleasure to play with you today. I can't wait for another play date.